It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest on Food Friday says baking is a great way to put things off for a while. Meet the author of the book, Procrastibaking. First, human history is full of epidemics, from the Black Death in the Middle Ages to more recent ones like Ebola, cholera, and now, of course, the novel coronavirus. The events themselves have been discussed and researched, mostly with a focus on locations, numbers, causes, and how they ultimately ended. We wanted to revisit a conversation about the biology and beyond to see how human behavior affected the spread of diseases and how epidemics have changed human history. Frank M. Snowden is Professor Emeritus of History and the History of Medicine at Yale University. His previous books include The Conquest of Malaria, Italy, 1900 to 1962, and Naples in the Time of Cholera, 1884 to 1911. His most recent book is Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. He joined us from Italy earlier this year. Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, your book came out before the new coronavirus emerged, and you, I understand, have been affected by the disease since then, in part as you went over to research in Italy. Can you tell us about some of the ironies you've encountered since your book came out?
Oh, there are lots of ironies, I must say. Yes, I came over. The book was published in October, and at the time, I had mentioned in the book that it was likely, very likely, as many people had said before, virologists have always thought that a respiratory pandemic was very much a likely possibility of our future, and I was worried about that as well, and said so in the book. And then in December, I never thought that it would happen at that moment or with this particular sort of depth, in-depth pandemic. So that was a first irony, which was to have imagined that something would happen along these lines and then have it actually start in December. Then I came in January hoping to do research on something entirely different, and the pandemic started, and I've done quite a bit of work on Italian history too, and so it was a very odd experience to find myself at the center of all of my interests in a very unhappy way, as Italy became the epicenter of the global pandemic for a while. It was interesting, and then I got to make lots of international comparisons, but then I guess I had too much enthusiasm for my work, and so I contracted the disease as well, and that I don't recommend to anyone, but I was very lucky to have a mild case. I've recovered, and the lasting sort of symptom, I guess, is quite an enduring sort of fatigue. But apart from that, I'm fine, and I'm fully back at work. So it has a story personally that has a happy ending. And then the country around me, Italy, is now on the right track. The cases or numbers and fatalities are going down. And slowly, slowly, according to a well-worked-out plan, the country is beginning to attempt to go back to normal, well, life post-COVID, still social distancing, but to restarting the economy. Let's put it that way.
Now, the biology of the disease, of any disease, we're seeing this now, is just part of the picture. You focus a lot on the relationship that a disease has to the way we live, the way we think about diseases, and the way we react to them. Why is it important to get that bigger picture of any given disease and how it affects humans?
Yes. Well, it's diseases, not helpful to think of them as simply interchangeable causes of death, because the biology of each of them is significantly different. Some are carried by insects. Some are carried by the air, some are sexually transmitted, others, some are viral, some are parasitical, some are caused by bacteria. So all of those are major differences. And with that go extremely different symptoms and the mode of transmission, the symptoms, and then the sort of how lethal and deadly and how easily transmissible they are. And then we find that they are also very different in terms of how long they affect a community. And some besiege a city for months and months, and others don't. And the impact really depends a lot on all of those factors, so that a disease that spreads through the air is much more easily transmissible to anyone in a society than a disease that spread, let's say, through filth and the oral fecal route, through the contamination of water and food, which almost entirely, exclusively targets people who live in desperately unhygienic and impoverished situations. So the way the sectors of society that are affected, the kind of disease, whether it's familiar to the population or entirely new, an emergent disease like COVID, people react differently. And the ideas that people have in their heads, whether they think it's a punishment of God or they think that it's caused by a particular ethnic group, or whether they believe that it's transmitted by, as modern public health and epidemiology would explain, this disease through the air, and is by anyone who's at the wrong place at the wrong time. So all of those factors make a huge impression that's different in terms of how society reacts and the legacy that the disease leaves in its wake.
We're talking to historian Frank Snowden about his most recent book, Epidemics and Society from the Black Death to the Present. I want to take a tour of some of the stories you share in the book, Frank. And one of the most striking was this before and after story that has to do with tuberculosis. Before we figured out it was caused, before germ theory came along with an explanation, and after. Can you talk about this radical change and what we thought about the disease and who it affected?
Yes, absolutely. Tuberculosis was thought in the beginning of the 19th century that it was a hereditary disease. It was a manifestation. This was the official medical theory, that it was a manifestation of your innate composition as a person, your inner nature. And therefore, people weren't guilty of contracting tuberculosis. They couldn't blame them. It was a hereditary disease, it was thought. And the point then is that it was also thought to be in line with religious ideas, that it wasted away the flesh and left behind a body that was more beautiful, it was thought. It's hard for the modern imagination to conceive of this, because it's a dreadful disease and people die in agony. But nonetheless, it was thought to make people more intelligent, more physically attractive, to enhance their genius. And so you had, for example, John Keats, was sort of a poster child for tuberculosis, and it was thought to have made his poetic genius. It created enormous genius, and his poetic genius was said to have flourished because of this terrible disease that he had that killed him within a year. Similarly, there's an apocryphal story about Victor Hugo. It said that his friends used to tease him that if only he had tuberculosis, which he didn't, then he would have been a much greater writer. And so it was the style at the time then to accentuate, for example, fashion and painting, considered that people who had tuberculosis were more refined and elegant, and that they were somehow better people and more geniuses. And people worried in the United States, social commentators, as the disease began to recede later in the century, that, oh dear, that the United States will lose its geniuses, its productive artists, and the society will begin to decline because we need tuberculosis to elicit genius. Well, in 1883, Robert Koch, the great German microbiologist, discovered the bacterium that causes tuberculosis. And from that time, the whole picture of the disease entirely changed. In the first half of the century, you could have operas about tuberculous heroines dying a beautiful death on the stage, or Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin isn't just about slavery, it's also about tuberculosis. And there's the protagonist has a beautiful death. Even her father thinks that her death of tuberculosis was sublime and uplifting for everyone who witnessed it. Well, with the coming of the knowledge that tuberculosis was transmissible person to person, that it wasn't hereditary, there was a microbe that caused it, and it was dangerously contagious, the whole idea of the disease was different. It was seen that it was primarily a disease of the poor, and the whole idea was that it was then seen as a disgusting and stigmatizing disease, and people who had it were no longer welcome at sites to take the cure. There were signs posted everywhere by departments of health. The Department of Health of Illinois said it's a vile, disgusting disease of vile and disgusting people. And not a very empathetic way of putting it, but it does give the idea of stigma became the feature of tuberculosis once that it was identified not with the elite and the cultured and the geniuses and the beautiful, but rather with those who lived in slums, in cramped housing, with deficient diets, with particulate matter in the air, and tenement living and working in sweatshops and those sorts of conditions. So those are two different moments in the way that tuberculosis was perceived.
We're listening back to a conversation with Frank Snowden. He's an emeritus professor of history and the history of medicine at Yale University. His latest book is Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. And we want to hear from you. How do you think that the coronavirus pandemic is going to change us as individuals, as a country, maybe as a species? Do you think the changes will be positive, negative in the long run, or a little of each? Do you see ways already that culture or the arts are evolving because of the pandemic? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening back to a conversation with Frank Snowden about epidemics and how they've shaped humans and human history. He's an emeritus professor of history and the history of medicine at Yale University. His latest book is called Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. What do you think? Do you think that the coronavirus pandemic will change cultures? In what ways? Are you seeing changes already? If you are, do you think they'll stay in place when we go back to more normal everyday life? Or will they fall to the wayside? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Frank, I wanted to get into another theme of your book that I think you come back to a few different times, the idea that we sometimes think we just need one magic bullet, the vaccine against a disease or drainage and sanitation for malaria or tuberculosis or whatever. In almost every case, it's more complicated than that. Can you talk about the vain quest for the magic bullet to sound diseases?
Yes, indeed. That is one of the perennial ideas that, and one sees this with COVID-19, that there will be a magic bullet that will extricate us from this dilemma. And most often it's the idea that a vaccine will be the magic bullet. There have been, mercury was thought to be the cure for syphilis. There have been many ideas of what the magic bullet might be across medical history. Often they've led to disappointing results because people imagine they'll somehow just eradicate the disease. It happens that vaccine development, that's the strongest hope now. There are a number of criteria for what kind of disease is most likely to produce a really highly effective vaccine. One would be if it doesn't have a reservoir in the animal kingdom apart from human beings, so that it won't spill over and reemerge once it's been conquered. Another criterion is that the vaccine that's likely to be highly effective is one that is creates in the human being who's actually suffered it naturally, produces a prolonged, life-lasting, highly effective immunity. And so that means that the task of scientists in the lab is to reproduce what nature already does. And so that's a much easier task than training the body to do something that it never would do naturally. Another criterion would be an, a highly effective disease against a disease that has florid symptoms that facilitate tracing the disease, where it is, and who needs to be vaccinated in a community. All of those were characteristic of smallpox. Had very florid symptoms, yet once you got smallpox, you had a lifelong immunity, and also that it was a disease that was one that doesn't have affect any animals except human beings, and so it would be impossible for it to come back. And it's not by chance that smallpox was the first and only disease to be eradicated by vaccination in the whole of human history. And I think there it's exceptional. There are lots of vaccines that are partially effective, but not ones that are totally effective. And against there are many diseases, HIV/AIDS would be one, tuberculosis would be another, malaria yet another, cholera another, against which a vaccine that's really effective has never been developed. And so my guess is that the vaccine against COVID-19 is likely to be partially effective, therefore a tool, a useful tool, will save lives, but is not going to mean that we'll live suddenly in a post-COVID-19 world. And I believe that probably we're likely to find this disease with us for a long time, and that we're going to have to adjust to it. It's not Armageddon. We'll just have to adjust our health system, our workways, the way we imagine our cities and our transportation, for example, in ways that make us possible to live and to go about our business and our lives without running severe risk of contracting this disease. That would be my expectation, at least.
Another running theme in your book is that with many diseases, particular populations or subgroups get scapegoated, whether that would be the Jews of Europe during the Black Plague, or we see stories of harassment of Asian Americans now during the coronavirus outbreak. Is this a running theme throughout a lot of diseases, this picking one group to scapegoat for it?
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, I think these pandemics are a little bit of a moral drama unfolding before us that actually bring out our best and our worst sides. Not every disease pandemic has created a surge of scapegoating, but many have. And as you said, the Jews were blamed for the Black Death, and there were major pogroms and outbursts of violent anti-Semitism. We know that during HIV/AIDS, there was the stigmatization of homosexuals held to be accountable for the disease. And now with COVID-19, we're unfortunately reproducing that, where we can see that disease across much of Europe, there are right-wing nationalist politicians who call it a disease of immigrants. And if just immigration were stopped and walls were put up, that would be the end of it, which actually wasn't true at all, but it's said by Le Pen in France, Salvini in Italy. And we see in the United States that President Trump has said that this is a disease that's a Chinese disease, a Wuhan disease, a foreign disease, and as if there was something in the DNA of Asian people that caused this disease. And the result of that has been an upsurge of xenophobia, and we've seen assaults on children of Asian descent in schools in America, and that Chinese Americans and other Asian Americans have been afraid to take subways in New York City because they're afraid that they'll be insulted or spat upon or physically assaulted. And so they try to travel in groups. And that's a really dark side, the witch hunting side of that's often people look for someone to blame. And that has led to this scapegoating and witch hunting and extraordinary violence. This has been something that worried very much Dr. Tedros, the Director General of the World Health Organization, who said that one of the things that was really complicating the response to the disease was another epidemic of misinformation and stigmatization that made it very difficult to carry out scientific public health, because public health depends on accurate, timely information if it's to be done in a scientific manner. And choosing a target that has nothing to do with the disease is a tremendous waste of misdirection of resources that are systematically misallocated, and it ties the hands of public health officials and so complicates the reaction to the disease and makes us much more vulnerable than we would be otherwise. So stigma is something that's very common and also very dangerous in times of pandemic disease.
Well, that's all the time we have, Frank. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. I know kind of late in the day on your side of the Atlantic right now.
It's my pleasure, and thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Frank Snowden is an emeritus professor of history and the history of medicine at Yale University. His newest book is Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. We talked to him earlier this year. Coming up after the news, if you've ever put off doing something else by baking, congratulations, you are a procrastibaker, and you'll be in good company coming up on Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on The Morning Show, fall in Wisconsin is a great time for canning and preserving lots of delicious produce. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests give us lots of advice on getting the most out of canning season. That's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, our Food Friday guest is a self-described unapologetic procrastinator, but her style of putting off work and then doing the work works for her. It also results in some pretty amazing baked goods. Erin Gardner is an award-winning cake designer, experienced pastry chef, blogger, and author. Her books include Erin Bakes Cake and her latest, Procrastibaking, 100 recipes for getting nothing done in the most delicious way possible. We talked with her a few months back. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so fun to be here.
I think people may know the concept, if not the word. Talk about what we mean by procrastibaking.
Well, procrastibaking is the baking you do when you should be doing something else.
And what do we get? What do you get, first of all, out of procrastibaking? You are a big fan.
I am. Well, you know, I am somewhat unusual, even in the world of procrastibaking, because while most people might bake to avoid, you know, writing a term paper or doing the laundry, I actually bake to avoid other baking.
Because that's your job. Like you need to bake, you need to test recipes and things like that.
Yeah, I test recipes. You know, in the cake world, I come up with tutorials and designs. You know, I kind of freelance for different magazines and various online outlets. And when I need to sort of ramp my brain up to get into that creative mode, sometimes I'll make something easy and fun and, you know, just something delicious that I can share with my friends and family. So that was this book. This book is full of those recipes that I make when I'm avoiding what I have to do.
We'll spend most of our time on the baking part, but I want to spend a little more time on the procrastinate part. You were starting to talk about some of the benefits of procrastination. Gets a bad rap, but you've looked at some of the psychological research and things like that, and it actually sometimes, not always, but sometimes can help us to procrastinate. How so?
Well, I mean, if you need to justify anything, I am your girl. So I'll just tell you that right now. But yeah, there's, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but there are different kinds of procrastinating. And I would like to think that procrastinating falls in the active procrastination category. So, you're stoking the fires of creativity. You're taking a little break from things that might be stressing you out, or the world at the moment. Just giving yourself some time in the kitchen where nothing else matters except for you and what you're making.
And I think probably a lot of us have experienced that sensation of you're plugging away at a problem, whatever it is, whether it's solving a baking problem or writing or whatever, and you grind away at it and you get nothing. And then you go do something else. This is something totally unrelated. And that's when the solution comes. Is that something that happens to you?
Absolutely. All the time. Absolutely. It's, I think sometimes when you kind of get into that hamster wheel moment where you're just rolling over something too much, you have to set it aside and, engage yourself in something else to keep the wheels turning, but to take a break from whatever it was that was really stressing you. And I think sometimes that's when the best ideas, the best, moments of creativity can really happen.
We're talking to Erin Gardner about her book, Procrastibaking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. Is this you? Do you do this at your own home? Join in and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you bake to procrastinate. Again, 800-642-1234. Will you give some, before we get into some recipes you shared with us, I want to get into some of the baking, some like baking advice, things you say come up again and again in your recipes. Like, for example, scraping down the sides of the bowl of our batter. Why are we always wanting to do that?
Absolutely. Well, it's so important if mostly when you're making, any recipe that is using a creaming method where you cream, you beat the butter and the sugar together, sometimes with other ingredients, and then you add the eggs. And in each one of those parts of the process, it's good, always good to stop, scrape down the sides of the bowl, and that way you don't create any chunks of unwanted things in your finished product, and you give your finished product the best chance of coming out the way that you want it to when the ingredients are really properly dispersed throughout the entire batter.
And another tip you say just about every time, and this is something that it's an article of faith for me. I do it when I have anything in the oven, rotate it halfway through. Why do we want to do that?
Yes. Well, every oven is different. Every oven. I mean, I've used, I don't know, probably hundreds of ovens in my lifetime, and they all act a little differently, and they all have their own personalities. There's hot spots and cool spots. So if you just show your baked good around the oven, it'll get the best of all of the spots and likely come out more evenly baked.
That is key. And I think my oven is just slightly off level too. So like if I have
Oh.
something in oil, the oil will move over to the northeast, or the batter might smoosh over and it's uneven. So yeah, that rotation is key. I should probably deal with the level of my oven though, huh?
For sure, for sure. Or at least maybe, the rack. Maybe you can
Oh, yeah.
shimmy the baking rack or something.
Maybe I'll try that instead. Well, you have shared
Yeah.
a few recipes with us for our procrastinate baking needs. We've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. You've got a lot of
Great.
cookies in your book. The one you shared with us is Butter Crunch Cookies. The picture, anyway, looks fantastic. Tell us about these
So
guys.
good. Oh, they're my all-time favorite cookie. They are everything good in the world. Chewy, crispy on the edges, butterscotch kind of flavored, brown sugar, a little salty, the little bits of crispy caramelly toffee kind of pool when you bake them. They don't get sticky. It's a great simple toffee recipe that goes in the cookies. It's just a nice, it's a really satisfying cookie when you've got any kind of dessert craving.
And toffee is easier to make than I think it is, it looks like, if I'm
Oh,
reading your
for
recipe
sure.
right.
Oh yeah. I mean, we're talking butter and sugar. That's it. And you just heat it together until it gets kind of warm golden brown. Pour it out on a sill pad or a piece of parchment paper, and then just smash it up to bits. It's a it's kind of a fun stress reliever, to be honest. You know, smash up your toffee, dump it into the cookie, and then it makes just the most delicious little crispy pools in your finished cookie.
That looks fantastic. That's the Butter Crunch Cookie. Again, we have that online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, you cover cookies and, you know, my favorite, which is, you know, your bars and brownie types of things. You've got cakes and candies. Do you, I know you do it all, but do you have a go-to where you're like, okay, I need some good procrastinating here? Is there like your main go-to type of baking?
Oh, wow.
The All answer of the above, is baking. It could be, yeah.
Well, I mean, I'd have to say cookies. You know, I put 100 recipes in the book, and 20 of them are cookies. You know, it's the biggest chunk of the book, and I'd say it's the biggest piece of my procrastinating life. You know, my kind of main gig revolves around cake, which I love cake, but cookies for me are lower stress. More fun to share. They can kind of hang around a little longer. And they're usually what my kids will reach for first as well. So they're just kind of more fun for us to have around at home, you know, on a day-to-day basis.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page what their favorite things to bake are to avoid doing other things. We heard from Cassandra, who says banana bread. I'm not really into kneading. And I'm kind of there, too. I like, you know, quick bread type cooking, zucchini breads and things like that. Do you have any favorites in the quick bread family?
Oh, for sure. You know, I kind of fall in the same boat. Like, I am not a bread person per se. I like really simple, basic breads, but I love loaf cakes. And I have a banana bread recipe in the book. One of the cool things about it is I've broken the recipe down to work for however many rotten bananas you happen to have on your counter that day. Because, you know, that's always the thing. Like, oh, I want to make banana bread. And you've got two, but the recipe like calls for one or four, or so, you know, I kind of took the guesswork out of that and boiled it down to this is what you do for one banana, and then you can just go from there with however many you have on hand.
We're talking with cake designer and pastry chef Erin Gardner about her new book, Procrastibaking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. And we want to hear from you. Do you procrastibake as we've described it? What do you put off and bake instead? What's your favorite thing to bake during COVID times? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening back to our Food Friday conversation with Erin Gardner, author of the new book, Procrastibaking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. And we want to hear from you. Do you like taking a slow and meandering approach to baking? What have you been making baking to take your mind off everything else that's going on in the world? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Let's bring on a caller now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So for my personal baking choice, I love to bake a good strawberry rhubarb pie using strawberry rhubarb as well as strawberries. But the reason I called is yesterday my sister gave me this banana bread as a smaller loaf with cinnamon on top. That was the fruits of her procrastibaking, which I'm super grateful for. And it was delicious. It didn't make it from Menominee Falls to like the zoo interchange. I mean, it was like done.
I'll point out to our guests that's not a very long way.
I figured, I mean, it sounds like you were really into it, and I'm into it now. That sounds great.
Fantastic, Marcus. Thanks so much. Well, that fruit pie reminds me of, I want to share another recipe that, well, that you shared, blueberry buckle. What is a buckle?
Yes. I think it's predominantly a New England thing, but I mean, anyone can make it anywhere. It's basically like a light, fluffy, biscuity dough that you use to hold together a really absurd amount of blueberries. So if you like baked fruit, it's kind of like the loaf cake version of a cobbler. But it's a really, really terrific thing to make this time of year when, you know, blueberries are kind of abundant and headed on the way out. You can swap in some peaches, some, you know, chopped up apricots, whatever fruit you have on hand will work in that recipe. It's great for breakfast, too. I love it for a breakfast or a brunch.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Marcus, and sharing that pie. And I like your strategy of having somebody else procrastinate for you, too. That can't hurt. Let's go back to our
clever
callers now. Definitely. Mary Beth is with us in Thorpe now. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi. Thanks
for
taking my
call.
What
do you want to tell us
about? Yeah. Hi.
Yeah, so over the years, I love making spritz cookies, but and I've bought many different types of gadgets, and I just can't seem to make a good spritz cookie. I can make the dough fine, but I can't get it out of the canister. Could you give me some tips?
Sure. I think with spritz cookies, the like you just mentioned, the tool that you're using is key. There's a lot of ones out there that have plastic parts. So then when you try to go and squeeze your cookies out, it kind of can fall apart on you if the dough is too firm. There are other spritz cookie makers. I can't think of any brand names off the top of my head, but they're made out of metal. And if you kind of, you know, look, search online or, you know, some baking supply stores, you can find ones with metal parts, which I highly recommend over the plastic ones. And then as far as the dough goes, you know, don't be afraid to warm it up a little. You know, if you need to put it in a zip top bag and kind of knead it a little with the warmth of your hands just to get the dough a little more pliable, that could help you get it out of the spritz cookie press. And also you can add a tiny bit of water to your dough if it feels too dry, if it feels too firm. You know, that shouldn't alter the consistency of the cookie too much. It'll just soften it enough so that you can get it into the shape that you want.
Fantastic, Mary Beth. Good luck. Report back and let us know how that worked for you. Don joins us now in Fish Creek. Don, hello.
Good afternoon, and thanks for the show. I don't know if what I'm doing could be called procrastinating at all, but I have a hand Corona mill, so I'm making Corona bread. But I just harvested 30 pounds of rye berries from my home garden that I'll be using for my baking. So I ground flour, and just before I heard the show on, I'm about ready to I did the second rise on my yeasted bread today, and I'm about ready to butter the bread pan. So I use a little combination of butter and whatever oil I have in the bread, and I use a Pyrex baking dish, you know, loaf pans, and I never had anything stick. And so anyway, I've been doing bread for 40-some years, and I think I got started with the Tassajara bread book that I ordered through the First Whole Earth catalog or something way back.
Don, I got to ask you. You've been
Corona Mill also. So anyway, I'll listen and.
I wanted to ask you though, Don. You've been baking all this time. Have you always been growing your own rye, or is that a new part of the operation?
I've experimented with the limits of home garden to market gardening, and I've been experimenting with growing grains, hulls, barley, oats, wheat, and rye. Wow. Rye is fairly easy. I figured out I'm a little bit mechanically inclined, and I figured out how to do some pretty good quantities of stuff with some everyday equipment as far as threshing, and we get a good breeze up here.
Wow.
You know,
you've taken this to another level. I'm really impressed.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Don. And that makes me think you've got recipes in there, Aaron, where you can kind of inflate or deflate to fill the time you need. So you say, you write in the book, you know, some recipes, you can buy a pre-made dough or something like that, or I guess you can go to Don's extreme and start baking your bread in August by planting the rye in the spring.
I appreciate Don's level of commitment. I think that's really cool. But yeah, as far as the book goes, I have the recipes sort of divided up in each chapter by the ones that take the least amount of time at the beginning of the chapter, and then ones that take the longest time at the end of the chapter. And then in the book overall, the last chapter is called Procrastin Masterpieces. So if you really need to kill some time, and actually with the holidays coming up, that chapter could get a lot of use. Like I do a gingerbread house from scratch, you know, some layer cakes and some roll cakes. Just those are the ones that, you know, you can really just take a day and dive into your baking and have some fun.
Erin Gardner is with us. Her new book is Procrasta Baking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. We've got one more recipe I wanted to get into a little bit, a giant cinnamon roll scone. And
yes.
I gotta ask, sometimes the I've never made scones myself, and part of why I fear them is that sometimes when I have other people's scones, they're kind of dry. They're like too dry for me. How do we make sure scones don't end up too dry?
Well, that is a scone pitfall. You know, and with this recipe, it's you know, it's put together in such a way that the there's enough butter and then there's the liquid at the end that pulls it all together. I use heavy cream. So those two combined make for a pretty tender scone. The other thing that I do with my scone, in some recipes that you just press the butter into the flour and then kind of toss it all together with your fingers to make a dough. With mine, I go the extra step of then folding the dough, giving it a biscuit fold. So that way you end up with really flaky layers and that those thin sheets of pressed butter sort of end up all throughout your scone so that you don't have those dry, crumbly pockets like you do in some other scone recipes.
Wow, that sounds really good. And now why?
It's fun. Yeah, it's a good one.
Why are we doing giant scones? Just because we want to eat a lot of scone?
Because it's fun. Yeah, because why not? You know, I was inspired by actually another baker, Michelle Lopez from Hummingbird High. She was working on a cinnamon roll scone recipe, and she was making little individual ones. And I thought, whoa, what if I just made a giant one and then cut it into wedges? Because, you know, traditionally with a scone, you pat the dough into a big circle and then cut it into wedges and bake it. So I thought, oh, wow, how fun would it be if you could make the scone look like a giant cinnamon roll, cut it into the wedges, bake it. And, you know, it's an easy way to make a really big impact. If you're having a brunch, if you just want to have a really special breakfast for yourself or your family, you know, it just makes that impact. Like everyone who sees it just wants to dive right in.
Now, one thing, I don't think it came up in your book, but, you know, with people stuck at home, they can't do out as much mm-hmm. stuff. Obviously, baking is a great thing. What do you think of baking as a group project for that family who's like, okay, we've all been on our phones for a while. Let's do something together that isn't enough just watching another screen.
Oh, totally. No, I think it's a great way to, you know, I think it's a great way to bake with kids of all ages. I have young kids. I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old. Both of them love to help me out, but only to a point, you know, they kind of will tap out at a certain point. So then I know that's going to happen. So I know that I'm going to be there finishing the project. But I also think it can be a great way to connect with older kids. You know, I have friends and people that I know with, you know, tweens and teens at home, and it's really hard on them. You know, there can be more difficult to entertain than the little kids sometimes. So getting them involved in a recipe, you know, having that time together, I think can be a really great way to connect. And then a great way to kind of build self-esteem where you see the fruits of your labor right in front of you and you watch people enjoy what you've made.
In our last few moments, sources tell me, Erin, you're talking to us from your kitchen right now. Do you
I
have
am,
a
yeah.
procrastinate baking project in your head that you'll work on this afternoon?
Oh, no, I think this after it's 90 degrees here where
oh,
I am
fair.
In New Hampshire. So I'm going to work on ordering pizza this afternoon.
That sounds great. Well, you've got some no bake recipes too in the book. Maybe I'll think about those
sure.
as it heats up the rest of this
yeah.
month.
Yeah. No, Erin, I was actually just, oh, sorry.
That's okay. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
That was cake designer and pastry chef, blogger, and author Erin Gardner. We talked with her back in the summer about her latest book, Procrastibaking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. You can find the recipes she shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the Foxconn project was launched with high hopes, but the state says it hasn't lived up to expectations. We'll find out why some state leaders are looking for a renegotiation. And some people in big cities have been looking at rural life lately. We'll look at the latest trends, and you can share your own thoughts on city living and country living. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. What is the longest bit of traveling you've ever done in one stretch? And I mean the time you're actually in motion, right? The road trip between gas stops, the epic hike or bike ride, the big long flight, whatever. Get a number in your head, the number of hours it took. Now, how about this? 68 hours nonstop. That was the travel time for Harper, an adult female great blue heron. The Heron Observation Network of Maine posted on Facebook that Harper had made the huge nonstop trip from New Brunswick in Canada to the southern Georgia coastline with a connecting flight to the Florida Everglades afterward. They followed Harper's trip using a tiny solar-powered GPS device. 68 hours, how do you top that? You head over to the Pacific Ocean for a 224-hour nonstop flight. The Guardian reports that a male bar-tailed godwit, that's a bird, made the journey from Alaska to New Zealand, 7,500 miles from September 16th to 27th of this year. The distance of the flight set a new record for the longest known recorded flight by any bird. That bird's known as 4BBRW after the pattern of the tracking band on it. So next time, say your kids or whoever starts asking, are we there yet on a road trip? Tell them the stories of Harper the Heron and 4BBRW the Godwit. It won't help, but it'll keep everybody occupied for a couple few minutes. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.